Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Julian Palmer with the National Center for Children in Poverty, who discusses a report recently released by his group that concludes almost 20% of the children in the United States now live in poverty. Kevin Rudinger of the Direct Action Network, who explains why a broad coalition of groups is protesting against the Democrats as they gather in Los Angeles for their national nominating convention. And Butch Kakahu and Alfred Wong of the Kauani Foundation, who talk about why some Native Hawaiians are pressing for repatriation of stolen lands and sovereignty. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After the Israeli army withdrew its forces out of Lebanon this spring, Palestinian refugees like Salim Yassin, who was born in a refugee camp in 1966, was finally able to get a view of Israeli territory. Like tens of thousands of displaced Palestinians, Yassin traveled to the Lebanese-Israeli border to seek out long-lost relatives and get a look at the country Palestinians were forced out of in 1948. Today, over 350,000 Palestinians live in refugee camps in Lebanon, with little hope of returning to their ancestors' homes inside the State of Israel. Life is bleak inside the refugee camps. Adults pass the time by smoking cigarettes, and children play soccer in back alleys near bullet-scarred tin and cement buildings. Yassin is now unemployed, after being laid off from a job with a French aid organization. Even if a final peace deal between Israel and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat is reached in the coming months, Yassin sees little hope of returning to his parents' hometown of Nazareth. For now, he must stay in a Lebanese refugee camp. Yassin laments, "I feel that this is as close as I can get to my home." After a brief ceasefire, bloodshed has returned to the disputed province of Kashmir. For 2 weeks in late July, a pro-independence group, the Hizbul Mujahideen, imposed a ceasefire and proposed full-scale talks with the Indian government, which has ruled the region for over 50 years. But on August 8th, fighting resumed. The rebels charged that India had failed to accept neighboring Pakistan as a full partner in the peace process. The group launched attacks against an Indian army post, and a car bomb exploded in Kashmir's summer capital of Srinagar, killing 9 and injuring 25 people. According to The Economist magazine, India blames Pakistan for the turmoil. The Indian government is eager to win approval with the Clinton administration, which is currently upset with Pakistan's new military rulers. For its part, Pakistan desperately wants to be part of any peace deal over Kashmir. In the short term, India is likely to seek out new peace partners who do not have direct links with Pakistan. India could also win more friends in Kashmir by respecting human rights and not inflaming local rivalries in an area where 30,000 have died over the last decade in the fight over Kashmir's future. With India and Pakistan having joined the nuclear club, most Western diplomats now worry the conflict over Kashmir could heat up. The Economist observes that the main concern is that any war over Kashmir might not stay conventional but go nuclear. This summer's big surge in gasoline prices could be just the beginning, with E! The Environmental magazine reporting that over the next 15 years, a growing oil shortage could panic drivers as known crude oil reserves are pumped dry. According to a 1998 report in Scientific American, global demand for oil could exceed existing oil reserves by the year 2007. Many oil industry insiders see a long-term crisis. Meanwhile, auto companies are making huge profits catering to American consumers' desire to drive gas-guzzling sport utility vehicles. Ford, for example, makes the bulk of its $3.7 billion profit from two SUVs, the Ford Explorer and Lincoln Navigator. As Winona Howder of Public Citizen's Critical Mass Energy Project states, the rise in oil prices is going to help the domestic agenda of oil companies that drill in the United States. They are going to be able to leverage the high oil prices to do things like change the policy to drill in the 15-million-acre Arctic refuge and ease environmental regulations. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari. We'll be right back.
In a farewell address at the Democratic National Convention in Los Angeles, President Clinton listed with pride the accomplishments of his administration. Among the achievements he touted was the lowest child poverty rate in 20 years. But the National Center for Children in Poverty contradicted the president's assertion in a recent report, which found that the percentage of children growing up in impoverished households has risen from 16.2% in 1979 to 19% in 1998, an increase of 15%. Although since 1993, economic good times have begun to reverse these trends, 3 million more children live in poverty now than they did in 1979. In fact, the U.S. child poverty rate is often 2 or 3 times higher than that of most other Western industrialized nations. The percentage of children living in poverty is highest for African Americans at a shocking 37%, while 34% of Latino and 11% of white children live below the official poverty line. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Julian Palmer, Communications Director with the National Center for Children in Poverty, who discusses his group's report and the political will necessary to substantively address this national disgrace.
According to the most recent data we have from the Census Bureau, there are 13.3 million children in the United States now in poverty. That's about 19%, or almost 1 out of every 5 kids growing up in this country is in poverty. And that obviously is unacceptable, especially so far into an economic recovery as we are now. That said, we looked at poverty rates and trends over the last 2 decades, and we found some interesting things. First, since 1993, there's some signs of hope. The poverty rate has come down about 17% since 1993 and has improved. But then if you look back over the whole 2-decade period, unfortunately, that recent improvement has still left us with a poverty rate that's significantly higher than it was in 1979. So basically, we've got a high level of poverty now. It's improved somewhat recently, but still remains higher than 2 decades ago. And then within that, we looked at the trends within each of the 50 states and found some interesting comparisons between states that were doing well and states that were doing poorly.
Before we get into some more of the statistics and the like, I wondered if you would comment and describe for us what we mean when we say child poverty in the United States, because I think for many of us who are lucky, we don't know what it's like to be poor in this country and the tangible effects of living and growing up, especially in those formative years, growing up in poverty.
Yeah, important question. I mean, first, just kind of the way it's measured. And then I could say a little bit about some of what research tells us about its impact on children. We used to measure poverty the official poverty threshold that the Census Bureau uses, which is about $17,000 a year for a family of 4. And that figure, by the way, is not adjusted to reflect local cost of living. So if we took differences in local cost of living into effect, the picture would be worse than it is. According to the official poverty measure that the Census Bureau used and that we used in our study. As far as the actual impact on kids, there's a whole body of research that shows that poverty has a negative effect on kids from birth through childhood into adulthood. I mean, starting with higher infant mortality rates for kids who were born into low-income families, greater likelihood that they won't enter school ready to learn and that they won't perform as well as in school, more likely to drop out of school, more likely to be unemployed as adults, have health problems, less likely to contribute to productive workforce. There are a whole range, all these factors are there as increased risks for kids who grow up in poverty. Millions of families in this country, even with the strong economy, low unemployment, and big budget surpluses, we still find a lot of families that face these regular choices, between food and light, and paying basic bills. It's also important to qualify too, though, that doesn't mean that every kid who's poor is going to have these problems. In fact, most poor kids are you know, will be employed, will graduate high school, you know, and will be okay. But on average, they're significantly more likely to have these problems, and ultimately that hurts them and hurts our whole society and the communities that we all live in.
I would certainly, for my part, say that both political parties have failed in terms of addressing substantively the issue of child poverty and the growing gap between rich and poor in this country. And while certainly around campaign time you're going to get some rhetoric in that direction, I'm pessimistic that we're going to see real action on these issues unless there is public pressure. So I would ask you, does the public support, expanding government programs to effectively help those families, and especially the children, who are certainly innocent victims of impoverishment? And it costs society in the long run not to address these dilemmas and these problems early on. Is the public support out there, in your opinion, to really address these questions and put money into programs that could move us forward in the direction of reducing poverty in this country?
Well, that's a very important question, and a good question. I mean, we've actually done a lot of attitudinal research, you know, surveys to try to understand how is it that Americans could accept nearly one out of five kids in this rich country living in poverty. I think we found if people sort of perceive it as, you know, government in general is going to fix this problem, there is skepticism. But if you get more specific and focused and say, you know, should, you know, all kids have access to affordable health insurance, people will say overwhelmingly yes. Should low-income families have access to affordable child care, and, you know, would you be willing to pay more taxes to make sure that they have it? The answer is yes. One other thing we asked people in a survey is, would you be willing to invest 10% or more of the projected federal surplus in efforts to reduce child poverty? We found about two-thirds of Americans would do that, and that would be 10% of the surplus at $4 trillion. You know, the surplus is now projected at $4 trillion. That would be $400 billion over 10 years, and you could make a serious dent in our child poverty problem at just spending 10% of the surplus. You could provide a lot of these things like affordable health insurance and child care and an increased earned income tax credit with just, you know, again, 10% of that surplus, and the public would support it.
That was Julian Palmer with the National Center for Children in Poverty. Contact the center by calling area code 212-304-7100 or visit their website at www.nccp.org. Many of the same groups that came to Philadelphia to protest at the Republican National Convention also came to Los Angeles to demonstrate against the Democrats during their nominating convention. Thousands of activists took to the streets to focus attention on critical issues that they say neither the Republican nor Democratic parties have seriously addressed. Both parties, protesters say, have been bought and paid for by the same set of giant transnational corporations undermining democracy. The week was filled with legal demonstrations and nonviolent civil disobedience to draw attention to a number of issues, including opposition to the death penalty, the prison industrial complex, corporate globalization, and the growing gap between the rich and poor. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Kevin Rudinger of the Direct Action Network, who explains why a broad coalition of groups is protesting against the Democrats and how nonviolent civil disobedience is being used to effect social change.
Really a festival of resistance that's happening all over Los Angeles, people challenging the Democrats and really demanding an end to both the racist and elitist nature of the policies of both the Democratic and the Republican parties. There's a series of marches and direct actions happening throughout the week, which are based around a series of themes. On Monday, the theme is human need, not corporate greed, and demanding a reprioritization of spending towards human needs like education, universal health care. Tuesday is the theme is an injury to one is an injury to all, and it's marches against racism, sexism, and homophobia. Wednesday is around the criminal justice system, stopping police brutality, mandatory sentencing laws, and the death penalty. And then Thursday is again around militarism and defending immigrant rights, workers' rights. and environmental justice. And we think that, you know, there'll be a series of very powerful actions, and we're hopeful that we're going to be able to get our message out and to, you know, provide a boost for longer-term movement building.
Tell us a little bit why the Democrats are being targeted here. Some people who consider themselves liberals, you know, say, hey, well, aren't you, the protesters, and the Democrats on the same side here on many issues? Why don't you just expand on the reasons why you're out in Los Angeles demonstrating against the policies of the Democrats?
Sure. I think, you know, if you sort of listen to the speeches of Al Gore, you might think that if you hadn't seen about, you know, what the real legacy of the Democratic Party has been. I think, you know, Al Gore has been very good, and the sort of rhetoric has always been about, you know, providing for human needs. But the bottom line is that hasn't happened. The last 8 years, we've seen tremendous cuts in social services. We've seen expanded attacks on immigrants. We've seen increased militarization in places like Colombia, the continuation of the genocidal sanctions against Iraq. And so we actually see, in terms of substantive policies, that there's very little difference between what the Clinton-Gore administration has done versus the Reagan and Bush administrations prior to that. And so we're just out here saying that enough is enough. We're not going to tolerate continued corporate-dominated political systems, and we're going to continue to build movements which hold decision-makers accountable.
Since Seattle, the police have changed tactics in a number of ways, looking at what happened in Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia most recently. They have executed preemptive strikes, really, to seize puppets. Puppets seem to be a very potent weapon of this movement, and the police are fearful of puppets because they seem to do everything they can to undermine this protest movement's effort to get puppets on the street. There is certainly a big issue about freedom of speech and your constitutional right to exercise that speech on the streets around these conventions or meetings of these giant world financial institutions.
Mm-hmm.
What is going on here, in your opinion, with the police crackdown?
Well, I can't say that we've been surprised. I mean, you know, here in Los Angeles, we're in the midst of one of the largest police corruption scandal in police history, and our action on Wednesday is a march on the Rampart Station that's been responsible for so many of the most visible cases of brutality against innocent community members. But, you know, we are concerned about the level of police repression and police violence, and we're very happy that the court ruled that the police were barred from further surveillance of the center and barred from entering the Convergence Center, where we're doing a lot of our puppet making and trainings. And we feel like that's a very clear statement by the judge to uphold constitutional rights and to, you know, demand that the police not continue the types of preemptive tactics that they have used in Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. Obviously, that doesn't fully address the issue. I mean, the court order dealt with preemptive strikes, and it doesn't really deal with what happens once people do head out into the street. We've committed ourselves again and again to nonviolence, and we hope that we can count on them to do the same.
There has been a lot of discussion about if protesters indeed, even though nonviolently and peaceably, are going to break the law by blocking traffic or delegates from getting into the convention in this case, that the police somehow have an obligation to keep public order and prevent chaos in a big downtown area like Los Angeles. How do you respond to that idea that if they are surveilling you or doing preemptive strikes, that it's only in response to an illegal act that is indeed being planned?
I think it's a very, very dangerous idea in a democratic society to say we're surveilling people because we're concerned about what nonviolence, clearly people with a history of nonviolence, what they might potentially do. And we're really concerned about the potential of that to free speech. We feel like clearly if people are blocking an intersection in a non-permitted march and are doing that, then certainly, you know, it's the role of the police to move in. But we do want to say that, you know, civil disobedience has a long history in the civil rights movement in other countries, and we feel like it is an effective and legitimate way to get our message out. And, you know, we hope that the police will respect that and, you know, treat protesters in a peaceful manner. We don't feel like it's the role of the police to try to squelch protest movements, and we feel like here in Los Angeles that is largely what they've done.
That was Kevin Rudinger of the Direct Action Network in Los Angeles. Contact the network by calling area code 213-484-9396 or visit their website at www.d2kla.org. Earlier this month, hundreds of Native Hawaiians and their supporters marched and rallied in Washington, D.C. The goal, according to organizers of the Aloha 2000 March, was to start a dialogue about Hawaiian independence. More than 100 years ago, the U.S. Navy led a force that overthrew the government of Hawaiian Queen Lydia Liliuokalani. 5 years later, the island nation was annexed and, like Puerto Rico, became part of the American Commonwealth. Statehood for Hawaii came in 1959, but in 1993, President Clinton acknowledged the illegal nature of this annexation and signed an official apology to Native Hawaiians. For many activists, an apology is not enough. Native Hawaiians have some of the worst educational and economic indicators of any American ethnic group, and the highest rates of heart disease, cancer, strokes, and diabetes. According to Butch Kakahu and Alfred Wong of the Kauani Foundation, sponsor of the Aloha 2000 March, there's been some progress since the president's apology, including public hearings in December 1999, conducted by the U.S. Departments of Justice and the Interior. WMBR's David Goodman spoke with the two men about repatriation of stolen lands, independence, and the related social and economic issues.
For myself and I believe the Kauani Foundation, we see the Aloha March in 98, the Aloha March 2000, as an educational thing we're doing, a way to tell our story. Certainly, there are lots of people who think Hawaii surf and sand, but there's more to it. The illegal annexation, which obviously prompted the United States to formally apologize, was that was wrong, an injustice. It continues today. And the plight of our people is one where, if you look at the statistics, we're down at the bottom in every category of health and in all these areas.
I've heard you say specifically that this is an educational mission. You don't, as of yet, have a specific outcome that Hawaii within the next 5 years needs to secede from the United States. But are there organizations working for just that? Do some people believe that the ultimate outcome should be that the United States should be 49 states and Hawaii should be a sovereign nation?
Well, let me answer that. My own opinion, where we should be headed, is to be independent, which we were independent before the gang came over. Okay, it was proof that there were no starving Hawaiians or unemployed Hawaiians. Everything was related to the barter system of caretaking everybody. Now we have over 1 million again, and because of the decline of our people when Captain Cook came over and it got assimilated with the culture, the new culture that are arriving here in the island, it has come to a point today that it has deteriorated our culture, and you know, language was banned, and the hula was banned, and finally we had to, in 1860, there was a law that we had to have a Christian name. So whatever the motive was back then when the missionaries came in, they did a good job on it. But now we're trying to recollect our thoughts and feeling on the language, the culture, and everything that goes for Kanaka Maoli. Kanaka Maoli is a term of Aboriginal, indigenous people from and the blood, which I am 100% Hawaiian.
Also, actually furthering on that, there are a number of organizations, and Hawaiians, like anyone, any other people, are very diverse in their opinions and passionate, and indeed that's no different for us Hawaiians. There are groups that feel that complete, as you say, independence is what should be done, just as it was back then. There are those that think otherwise, that feel that to have a similar status like Native Americans would be the way to go, but that would continue to place Hawaiians as wards of the state, as you would.
There's an argument that I've heard that says, well, we can't return the lands to the Native Americans because we've been living here hundreds of years, and there you are with your eighth of an acre plot in the suburbs. You can't give that land back. Is that a similar argument that you hear in Hawaii?
Well, let me add to that on that. Especially stony lands in a small area compared to this what the United States have here. Everything is documented, yeah. Bill conveyance and the title. So there was a lot of things that took place way back then. It was set up by, you know, I say maybe the second, maybe the third generation of the missionary families got there, figured out to stay with the king and tell him, well, I'll sit on the land commission, we'll help, give you the meets and bounds here. Well, the land in Hawaii has never disappeared. On the paper it did, and the documentation. Now, if they would have to come in today into Hawaii in year 2000, and with the intelligence we have today, I don't think they would have pulled a scam like that. They couldn't. But we were just a kind people that trusted other people to come into our land, especially through religion, to soft touch the people, like here in the indigenous people in this country. So again, if there's any feedback or repercussion on this, it's going to be on the documents, or let's say legal documents that the people have, because that's one of the things that's happening. Anything after January 18, after the 17th of the overthrow, we consider the next day what the United States supposedly have had under the control is till today is null and void. It's got to be.
That was Butch Kakahu and Alfred Wong of the Kauani Foundation. For more information on Hawaiian independence and related issues, call the foundation at 808-822-7643 or visit their website at www.alohamarch2000.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of David Goodman, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Currie.